Welcome to Contemplative Revolution, a WCCM podcast. I'm Elba Rodriguez. In this episode, we'll hear Father Lawrence Freeman speak about ripeness, a stage of the journey where a new dimension of knowledge is acquired, our identity becomes sharper as we become more mysterious to ourselves. This is the third talk of the Milestones series, recorded at the Meditatio Center in London.
So here's another short passage from the Four Quartets. What we call the beginning is often the end, and to make an end is to make a beginning. The end is where we start from. So this is the end of this little sequence of talks we call Milestones, looking at different phases of the human journey. And that idea of the beginning and the end of our life being somehow connected, that's a deep theme of the Four Quartets. It's also a theme of John Main's last newsletter, which he wrote just a few weeks before he died. He says the beginning and the end of our lives are like the two ends of a piece of string which come together to make this symbol of infinity, the circle. And so I think it's kind of appropriate that we might just begin with that reflection as we come to the last of this talks on the milestones, which I've called not old age or a senility or death, but ripeness, because that I think is what a meaningful understanding of the sequence of our lives is about. Ripeness is all, that we come to maturity. But when I began back on Ash Wednesday, I said that the word milestone comes to us from the Romans, and the Romans were great at measuring things, and they measured distances by 1,000 paces, mile, so milestone. And these milestones, which helped them to organize and control and measure their world, these milestones were both places of where direction is given, because you knew which way you were going. It was a reaffirmation, a reminder or encouragement that you were going in the right direction, and also a kind of a record of the distance that you've already covered. In our journey of life, milestones are less physical and particular than those Roman milestones. And we often don't know what a milestone is until it has been passed, of course. And it is something we look back on in memory, or through the present effect of that experience. So something happened, it goes into the past, maybe we forget about it in the stream of consciousness of daily living, and then periodically we look back to that moment or to that phase in our life, and we realize, well, that really was a turning point, that was a watershed, that was an epiphany moment. That was a milestone in my life. I didn't fully realize it at the time, but it gives a shape, a pattern, a record to my life. And of course, the longer you live, the more of these milestones there are. But they are related to meaning, ways in which we articulate meaning or see the pattern. Sometimes we can't translate that sense of meaning into ordinary language. Sometimes it needs music, sometimes art, or sometimes a physical experience, which allows us to see that meaning and feel it, even though we can't find ideas or words to express it. And we turn to great poetry like this to help us articulate it verbally. But certainly, one thing these milestones have in common is time. They are ways of measuring time and ways of our becoming conscious in time. Perhaps a milestone in our life is a measure of consciousness, a degree of consciousness. And time is mysterious. St. Augustine famously said in the Confessions that everybody knows what time is until you start to try to explain it. And then nobody can explain it. I don't know if you, have any of you seen the film Interstellar? No? A few nods. No. Well, Interstellar is very much about time. It's, I think, one of the great films, great modern films, and one of those films that you, it fulfills the, you know, that new medium of film, which is often, you know, we think of as sometimes very trivial and just light entertainment, but occasionally you realize that it is a medium for very deep and powerful, a new medium of very deep and powerful communication. And anyway, Interstellar seems to me to be one of those rare films. Anyway, I'll come back to Interstellar and black holes and a few other things that I don't understand in a moment. So Augustine says that we know what time is, but we can't really explain it. But it's also, at least in one of its dimensions, time is very simple. Time is linear. Time is an arrow going in one direction. In the film Interstellar, which is a very profound and also accurate in terms of the cutting edge of theoretical physics at this moment, there's a moment where the characters are facing the fact that they are living in different time experiences of time, according to the theory of relativity, from those that they live, those that they have lived with, and those who they love most in the world, but they are now in different times. So for one person, the time is going much more quickly than for another. And one of the characters who is tragically facing this sense of loss through time, of contact with the person he loved most, which was his daughter, he says to one of the physicists, you know, isn't there any way that we can turn this back by playing with the laws of physics and the black holes and the wormholes and so on in the cosmos? Because it's through these portals that time, different experiences of time, can be understood or experienced. And the physicist sort of laughs at him, really, and says, you can't do that. You know, we don't understand time, but the one thing we can say is that you can't go back. You can't turn the clock back. So that's one very simple, at times tragic, dimension of time, that it leads to death. It's the expression of the third law of thermodynamics, of entropy, the running down of energy within any system. I looked it up for an easy definition, but I don't think it's very easy. But it says, the entropy of a system approaches a constant value as the temperature approaches zero. So that explains it nicely, doesn't it? Right. But entropy is the measure of disorder in a system. So it's the breaking up of what we think of as an orderly, predictable view of the world or experience of reality. But actually, there is within reality this third law of thermodynamics that everything ultimately disengages from order and the level of disorder increases. In that film, Interstellar, the starting point is a picture of the Earth running out of energy, and not a great deal of information given about how that has happened, but basically we have ruined our home. We have destroyed our planet, and it's running out of the necessary elements to sustain human life. And so humanity is searching for a new home. And there aren't many planets in the universe, certainly no planets that we know of in our own solar system or anywhere where we can see, where we can be sure that there is a friendly environment. So in this film, they discover a great black hole or wormhole in space, many thousands of light years away. And they are able to see through that into a sector of the cosmos where they were able to discover two or three likely planets where we could all go before it's too late. And these wormholes or black holes are, and I'm not an expert on this, I'm being very, probably some of you may understand it much better than I do, but the points in space where space is folded. The idea was that you get something like this piece of paper. In fact, they show this in the film. And then you fold space. If you can fold space, that's what we're doing. We fold that piece of paper, right? And then you put a hole through the middle of it. So rather than having this huge distance, which is billions of light years, you bring them together, and it's a very small distance, except you've got to go through this strange thing called the wormhole, or the black hole, or death, maybe. So the film is about what happens when you go through this wormhole and find other worlds, entering into other dimensions, through what they call the singularity of the black hole. The singularity is a location or a space in which our consciousness, we could say, is not restricted by biology anymore, and in which we can expand infinitely. In these black holes or wormholes that Einstein predicted in 1916 when the theory of relativity came out, he predicted it long before it was able to be proven that they existed. And because they confounded his general view of physics, he didn't want to prove it. He didn't want it to be proved that these things did exist, but he kind of had proved that they existed theoretically before they were proven and discovered experimentally. But through these wormholes, these black holes, there at the heart of them is an object infinitely small, infinitely dense, a singularity. So a singularity, we could say, is something beyond which we cannot imagine. It has not entered into the heart of man to imagine what God has prepared for us, St. Paul says. We literally cannot image what lies beyond that horizon. of experience. The gravitational singularity, or in space-time, is a place where gravitational forces become infinite. You cannot imagine the infinite, that infinite density. So these are insights coming to us through theoretical physics. Much of the film is not proven fact, but it's the best theory of the cosmos, the best theory of reality, the best theory of matter and space and time that we have to go on at the moment. And this film, I think, does an exceptional service to people like me who don't understand this theoretically and can't read those equations, but who are able to relate to these insights through the imagination and through the imagery and through the metaphors. Because these insights, theoretical insights, probable insights, which give us new metaphors and new symbols to describe the human journey as we move from one milestone to the other. And the expansion or the discovery of these new insights, I think, liberates us, propels us into a new era of human consciousness. We are very conscious today of our living in crisis, in civilizations which seem to be deconstructing and with more and more examples of barbarism, like is happening in Syria, the destruction of those temples, and not to say the killing of hundreds of thousands of people, the huge migration, human migration crisis, which we're seeing happening in the railway station of Budapest today. So we're very conscious of living in times of entropy, times where, the great civilized institutions don't seem to be able to cope either with financial disorder or even with human disorder. So at times like this, we desperately need new hope, new ways of imagining, new metaphors, and new insights. It struck me as I was, during the summer, I took some time of retreat for myself, and I was reading John of the Cross, in particular his book called The Dark Night of the Soul, which he describes the human journey, the spiritual journey, the inner journey, if you like. But even that metaphor of inner journey is a little suspect. It's the human journey through what he calls, first of all, the night of the senses, where we, for example, in terms of prayer, begin to move a milestone moment where we move into contemplative prayer from our more familiar world of mental prayer, where we're speaking to God, thinking about God, discussing with God, bargaining with God, using this image of God in our prayer quite validly. And it's not that that is unreal or it's not prayer. It's just that there are other dimensions of prayer. And he describes how, as we move from this world of mental prayer, which gives us a lot of consolation, a lot of familiarity, a lot of reassurance, God is on my side. God will answer what I need. But we move to a deeper experience of God. And he says this is going to cause us some feeling of chaos, some feeling of loss, some feeling of disorientation, like going through these wormholes. And our way of measuring our universe, our world, our own experience, our own personality even, all of these familiar ways are going to be disturbed, and sometimes painfully disturbed. So he describes this very powerfully, very, very, with great psychological insight, but he also brings in some amazing spiritual insights into the nature of this milestone moment in our prayer life, in our spiritual journey. Later, of course, he goes on to the second night, which is the night of the spirit, which is where the mind or the heart or the soul of the person goes through a very dark and bleak feeling of abandonment, of disillusion, of loss of meaning, a very radical kind of unmaking of the whole of one's identity and of our relationship to God. It isn't that actually, according to him, that we cease to believe in God, it's just that we think God has ceased to believe in us and that God is no longer giving us what we need or cares for us and so on. So, my God, why have you forsaken me? So, John of the Cross, I think with amazing subtlety and deep experience, of course, describes, as far as it can be described, this journey, this part of the journey of the human existence. And I felt actually, as I was watching Interstellar for the second time, how much the imagery, the film imagery, related to John of the Cross's ideas of this passage of consciousness. So, time past and time future. What might have been and what has been point to one end, which is always present. Even though our minds can't understand time, and we can't prove any of this scientifically, we do come back continually to the present moment. That's the one reality. That's the one reliable and inescapable point of existence, the present moment. So we may not be able to understand the whole picture, but at least we know we're here. We are in the present moment. And this is the moment in the mystical vision, both John of the Cross, and I would say perhaps lying behind some of this theoretical physics, where the end and the beginning and the end are united. Where the two, as John Maine said, the two ends of the piece of string are brought together. My end is my beginning. With every milestone in our life, when we recognize it as a milestone, every milestone we could say is a new beginning. It's a death passage, and it's a birth canal. And as we go through this wormhole, or these black holes, or these radical moments of evolution and transition in our lives, we are, in a sense, a different person. But the difference is as important as the continuity of our identity. So we could say we are a different person, but we're obviously the same person. And the difference and the sameness are equally important. Eliot captures this with a beautiful image of travel, of a journey. And the image here is when you're sitting on a train and you're looking behind you, as in the opposite direction to which the train is traveling, the rails, the narrowing rails, slide together behind you. They seem to slide together. when you're on a boat, the wash, the furrow of the boat expands, doesn't it? Anyway, so this is what he says. Fare forward, travellers, not escaping from the past into different lives or into any future. You are not the same person, you are not the same people who left that station or who will arrive at any terminus. While the narrowing rails slide together behind you, watching the furrow that widens behind you, you shall not think the past is finished or the future is before us. So as we become conscious of these sort of milestone moments in our life, I think we sense something new, more familiar and yet stranger about ourselves. Our identity becomes both sharper, clearer, and at the same time we have become more mysterious to ourselves. And this surely is the overall unifying quest of our brief lives. It is to find out who we are and to know ourselves, because we cannot know the whole picture, God, without knowing that very small part of the picture that is me. Self-knowledge is the platform of our knowledge of God. We cannot know God without knowing ourselves. We cannot know ourselves, in fact, without knowing God. What's interesting is that this knowledge that we speak about, knowing ourselves, knowing who we are, knowing God, is for many people in our culture a confusing word to know, because it suggests that there is some kind of scientific, objective, cognitive proof that we can come to, in the same way we can know the structure of the atom or we can know the best way to Euston Station. So it's not that kind of knowledge. So what kind of knowledge is it? Well, the great scriptures of the world and our own scriptures, the biblical scriptures, say that this knowledge is love. And the great mystics, of course, have discovered this through their own experience. As the cloud of unknowing says, we can never know God by thought. We can only know God by love. But that is a real knowledge. It's just different from scientifically verifiable knowledge. It's a different dimension of knowledge. And interestingly, in this film, Interstellar, I think this is the last time I'll mention it, but this is one of the key dramatic elements of the film, is the love of the hero figure for his daughter, from whom he's separated by different all these different dimensions of time and space. And there is a theory in the film that the two forces in the universe that run through all dimensions of time and space are gravity and love. And love is a universal and prevailing force in reality, in the cosmos. So, as we meet, recognize the different milestones in our lives, we are, I think, made more conscious of how little we know about ourselves, and yet in knowing that, we know more about ourselves. We become wise a little because we know how little we know, and yet knowing that expands our knowledge and expands our understanding of how our self-knowledge, particular and small as we are, is connected to the knowledge of God, which is all knowledge through love. And so these milestones are really quite important portals, doors that we pass through. Maybe frightening, like the black hole. We don't know what's going to be on the other side of, because we can't see any further. But we have to go through it. There are things we simply have to go through, although we have no idea whether we'll get through or what they will be on the other side. And so at every one of these milestones, a new way of life begins. And our level of consciousness is expanded. I have come that you may have life, life in all its fullness, Jesus said. So in this milestone, in ripeness or in maturity, is it old or is it a new beginning? The word old is a bad word in our culture. It means it's something you should throw away. You can't fix it anymore. I'm wearing my new glasses, or my old glasses, which I broke a few weeks ago, and were incredibly difficult to fix, because this arm, you know, they don't make these anymore. So it took weeks and weeks to get them fixed. Are they new glasses? Well, they are to me now, because I can see things more clearly than with my old ones, 5 years old. Or are they new? Are they new or old? In our culture, old means redundant. It means unable to function in the present world. Or it means lacking in interest. Oh, that's an old story. I heard that one. And I think that misunderstanding of what is old underlies a great deal of our unhappiness, of our discontent, and of our being disrupted from the sequence of our lives and the wonder and the mystery of passing from one milestone to the next. Perhaps this milestone of ripeness or maturity is old biologically, but younger spiritually. God is always younger than we are, St. Augustine said. Sounds a little strange, but not if you're traveling through a black hole. In any case, these milestones, and this one in particular, needs a new kind of self-awareness. It will give us a new way of evaluating our life and ourselves. Our values and our priorities will change in this process, not overnight, but we will come to a more non-judgmental acceptance of ourselves, of our mistakes, of our accidents, of those who have hurt us, or failed us, or betrayed us, or those we have lost. So in this milestone, we take a long, hard look at ourselves. Painful, because we have to look at everything, at every aspect of ourselves, over the whole period of time that makes us who we are. But at the same time, as we have to be very honest with ourselves in a non-judgmental way, we have to be gentle with ourselves as well. We have to make sure that we have finally shed the fragments of our old selves, because we don't move neatly, like my notebooks, we don't move neatly from one milestone to the next. We have bits left over in different notebooks everywhere. So we still have bits of ourselves, fragments of our earlier identities, still lingering, which have not been integrated. These might be fragments, attitudes, patterns of ourselves, our old selves from childhood, formed in us even before we were conscious. They may be patterns and attitudes and desires from our adolescence that we should have outgrown by now, but haven't. Or desires and longings that are not realistic, but which still haunt us. Our failures, our mistakes, our misfortunes. What we need to do in order to go through this milestone is to accept them all and to integrate them all. We don't move on to the next stage until we have integrated everything of previous stages. And if we don't do that, biological old age does not become spiritually young. And actually, old age then becomes ridiculous. And it's ridiculous to itself. And, of course, in this culture, it's going to be seen as ridiculous by many others. I used to get these emails from someone which were both ageist and sexist. And I would always know what they were going to be before I opened it, but it was kind of like thinking how bad, how much worse could they get? And there were all these ageist jokes which seemed to me so full of self-hatred and self-rejection and meaninglessness, and just looking at the ridiculousness of old age. And then also all these sexist jokes as well about wives, all about wives, actually. And I thought, what on earth, what kind of mind tragically lonely and unself-accepting could produce this sort of torrent of meaninglessness. Anyway, fortunately, I don't get them anymore. I think as we enter into this milestone, we see that life is no longer about achievements or acquiring experience. In earlier stages, earlier milestones, of course, that's very much how we are focused. We have to achieve certain things, prove ourselves, be applauded, be recognized, be approved, maybe by our elders, and we have to acquire experience. It's sort of the hunger of youth. And in a sense, that begins to diminish. And it can be a great relief and release. I remember speaking to it was Raymond Panica, shortly before he died. And he'd had a stroke and wasn't able to have such an intense and active intellectual life as he did throughout his 80 years. And I asked him if he missed reading and writing and, you know, being involved in debates and arguments all the time as he was. And he smiled this very beautiful, gentle smile and said, "Actually, it's quite a relief." And this is also a milestone in which is kind of contra-sexual in a way. The very strong force in all the other milestones of life as we move from one phase of life to another, the Eros principle and the sexual energy. But in this milestone, there's a shedding of that, or a transformation of that. As B. Griffiths would say, really it's about a transformation of sexual energy rather than a repression of it. It's a shedding of the insecurities, the inadequacies, the disappointments of the sexual agenda, and even of the alarm bells of the sexual clock. But the end is not yet. As this process of integration completes itself, and we perhaps painfully recognize that there's still a little bit too much of our former selves hanging around, making trouble that have not yet been integrated, that has not been matured. As that happens, we discover new seeds of existence, new seeds of consciousness, new potential that we had not been aware of before, and with it a new sense of freedom. And in this period too, we probably give greater value and time to the integrity of our feelings. Often our feelings, we don't, in those earlier stages, we don't really understand our feelings, and we don't give them the time and the respect that we should, because we are driven by some goal, some achievement, or some desire. But as this process of integration happens, we begin to recognize the wisdom of our feelings, what messages they are carrying, and how we need to listen and feel them. And as that happens, what might seem to be the crisis of our life begins to transform into opportunity. The attention, or the kind of attention we give to the world, determines the world we're living in. That's why it's very important that we encourage as many people in the world to meditate as possible. Because the kind of attention that meditation makes possible changes the world. Because the kind of attention we give to the world determines the world we're living in. And as that quality of attention, that more patient and less driven quality of attention deepens, we discover many wonderful things. Whatever is hidden is meant to be disclosed, and whatever is concealed is meant to be brought out into the open. What seems to be loss is reimagined or rediscovered as finding. This period of ripeness begins with a contraction. Objectively speaking, you see the limitations that come with this, with the biological aspect of this process, for example, or even the psychological or neurological aspects of this phase of our lives. So it might seem as if there's a diminishment, a contraction, a loss of faculties, objectively speaking. But subjectively speaking, in other words, what we actually feel ourselves, that accepting that, okay, at that level, it's true. We're not as active or as capable of doing many things as we were before. And yet, that can be accepted because there is, to the inner eye, as it were, an expansion of consciousness. So even if physical and psychological faculties diminish, a sense of joy and liberty can expand. even if we feel less independent in the world, or we see others looking at us condescendingly. Nevertheless, a sense of our own identity and value can grow and expand. So what we're doing in this phase, in this milestone, is entering closer and closer through the wormhole of reality into the paradox of existence. The paradox that is exemplified in the story of the gospel. The paradox, fundamentally, of death and resurrection. All paradoxes are fruitful if, like the wormhole or the black hole, we actually enter into them. That's the big risk. And in a way, I think that's the risk we take when we meditate as well. You know, we can never be creative. We can never learn to love. We can never discover our true self or our true talents without taking a risk. And the risk is the risk of failure, the risk of loss, the risk of humiliation, the risk of meaninglessness. But if we don't take the risk, then it doesn't happen. We stay as far away from the wormhole as we can, out of fear. Maybe we conceptualize what it would be like if we went into the paradox of losing ourselves and finding ourselves, but we don't actually do it. It's like talking about meditation but not actually doing it. So all paradoxes are fruitful if we enter into them. And in this world of quantum physics, the wormhole, the black hole are shortcuts, actually, direct portals into other sectors of our ever-expanding universe. The frightening thing about these wormholes is that nothing escapes their gravitational pull. Even light is sucked into it. That's why it's called a black hole. And we don't know, as I said, what lies on the other side. So it's a very good image of death. Everything is sucked into it. Everything is taken away from us. We can possess nothing. A condition of complete simplicity costing not less than everything, as Julian of Norwich said. So I think depends when you started to meditate in your life, but if you started very young in your life, as we are trying to encourage more and more children to do, and through schools and through families, it would be a wonderful discovery through the different milestones of your life to see the meaning of these transitional moments through the paradox of meditation itself. Now, obviously, you know, if you're meditating at the age of 4, you're not going to be thinking about all of this. And your experience of meditation will be, it makes me feel more peaceful. I like it. Different stages in your life, you'll express that differently. You'll understand it differently. But also, the experience of the meditation, which has now become part of your life's journey, will shed a light even into those darkest spaces. It will give a meaning even to the most difficult conundrums of life, like loss or death. So I say at the heart of the gospel is this paradox of losing self so that you may find yourself, of dying so that you may rise again. And the best expression of that is this: is the Zen idea, or one of the very fine expressions of that, is the Zen idea of beginner's mind. Zen mind, beginner's mind. It's having a beginner's mind. Or, let's say, in the terms of the gospel, becoming like a child. So that you are able to experience and taste reality more sharply, more accurately, more directly, with less filters, less preconceptions, as you get older, or as you make this journey. Whether it's how much this is related to biological transition is another question. Some people may come to this very at a much earlier age. Others may not come to it, you know, to the very end. But certainly, this process, this passing from each of these milestones in our lives to the next, should be bringing us to a more simple beginner's mind, to that childlike state which Jesus says is our capacity to enter the kingdom of God. A sense of immediacy, a sense of the sacredness of the present moment, or what Blake called the holiness of minute particulars. Like a wise but mature child, filled with wonder at the mystery of the whole of our potential experience, the mystery of the world. So I think this milestone of ripeness, of maturity, though it may be associated with a sense of loss, a sense of approaching mortality and so on, can be viewed very differently. It isn't viewed this way in our culture, but in the great wisdom traditions, this is how we are invited to see this stage of life, this last phase of our life. An experience of greater experience of reality, the freshness and immediacy of the present moment. And in that, whatever our other aspects of loss may imply for us, or however much that may sadden us at times, that sadness of entropy, the running down of the system, the greater disorder of our lives, the approaching of our death, that is made very small compared with the feeling of being overwhelmed by the beauty of the whole. Simone Weil describes beauty as the smile of Christ rippling through the universe. And she says, when we encounter beauty in this way, we learn not to try to touch it or to possess it or to control it, but simply to enjoy it. Enjoyment is actually what this milestone of ripeness, maturity is about. And this is why it is so wonderful to meet people at the end, whatever age they may be actually, in this period of their journey, who are really enjoying life each day, each morning, each afternoon, to the full. I spoke about that last time, I think. And while living life to the full and drinking deeply from this wellspring of life that they now feel close to and one with, they are at the same time ready to let go, ready to be sucked in completely into that wormhole. And even eager in one sense, not that they're eager for death, but they are eager and ready to go to the next, to go the next step. And what is the next step? Maybe the next step is that we go into a universe where there are no milestones, where everything is present. And the condition which all of this maybe sounds abstract, but it's not really abstract when you meet people who are in that space, is beauty. We think of beauty very often in other ways, again in our culture. But to be with someone of whatever age or in whatever physical condition who has reached or is reaching that milestone of ripeness, maturity, that beauty is radiant, both physically and spiritually, through them, with them. And we're reminded that what is beauty? Beauty is the gift of the whole in a part. So the whole mystery, which we cannot imagine, gives itself to us in these moments, these objects, these people, these things, these words, whatever they are, of beauty. And with that comes the great humility of wisdom and a new perception of the fullness of the present moment. So let's end with a little bit more T.S. Eliot. And any action is a step to the block, to the fire, down the sea's throat, or to an illegible stone. And that is where we start. We die with the dying. See they depart, and we go with them. We are born with the dead. See they return, and bring us with them. The moment of the rose and the moment of the yew tree are of equal duration. A people without history is not redeemed from time, for history is a pattern of timeless moments.
You can hear more talks and conversations in the media section on our website, WCCM.org, or in your favorite podcast player. Thanks for listening. For WCCM, I am Elba Rodriguez.